Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mehler here, and we're starting this show today by talking about the power of science for you to use to produce healthier fruits and vegetables. And our guest is Robert Pavlis. Robert is a master gardener, an award-winning author, has 11 gardening books. He has degrees in chemistry and biochemistry, teaches many gardening courses, and has written articles for many popular magazines, such as Mother Earth News. And his latest book, the one we'll be talking about today, is titled Food Science for Gardeners: Grow, Harvest, and Prepare Nutrient-Dense Food. So we'll ask him about food safety, about handling and storing, preserving and growing, of course, all with nutrition in mind. And as I talk with him, I hope you'll join in with your questions. What would you like to know about growing healthy fruits and vegetables? Love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Robert Pavlis, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Hey, thanks very much. It's great to be here.
So I really have enjoyed reading your book. You know, science and chemistry, it can be, well, let's see, let me put it this way. I've interviewed chemists and biochemists on the show in the past, and some of them are really good at it, and others can make science sound sometimes almost incomprehensible. But you do a very good job of explaining it so that even somebody like me can understand it. And and you do it in an entertaining way. So thank you for writing it.
Well, thank you very much.
Why do gardeners need to know about nutrition?
Well, I guess they don't really need to know about it. Sorry about that. And I think most new gardeners don't bother with it, right? They just worry about actually growing the vegetables. And that's fine. And I think that's actually a very good approach. But I think as gardeners get more experienced, they start thinking about the food they're growing, and they want more nutrition in their food. The other thing is it's not just for gardeners. They're just people in general don't know a lot about the nutrition, about the food they buy, right? So even if you're a gardener, you're still going to the grocery store to buy things. And it's a combination of those things. And so then how do you process that? How do you take care of it? How do you pick healthy food and so on? And I guess you could look at it from the point of view that if you're going to grow your own food, one of the main goals is to produce something that's healthy to eat, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it makes sense. And I guess it's easy to say, grow better fruits and vegetables, but figuring out what that means isn't necessarily easy, is it?
No, in fact, it's very hard for a gardener to do that. Partly because there's very little information available. One of the things that I had never realized until I wrote the book was that the whole science of nutrition is quite a new science. It's not like some of the other things like chemistry and physics that have been around for hundreds of years. Nutrition is very new. And yet the headlines we see in newspapers make it sound as if scientists know all about nutrition. And so the headlines are always recommending things. The actual fact is our knowledge about nutrition is still very small. And we're just starting to get some of the important pieces of this out. So it's very difficult to get the information that we really want.
Yeah. Yeah. Were you surprised by what you found when you were kind of researching the book?
It's interesting. Whenever I write one of these books, I always learn a whole bunch. So there's always surprises. Probably the biggest surprise to me was that there's not even a proper definition of what nutrition is. Right. You would think from the headlines, like, we know all this. And we do know some things. We know about vitamins and we know about minerals, and we're starting to understand things about antioxidants. But the reality is that we know very little, and there's no accepted definition of what nutritious is. So when someone says, you know, an orange is more nutritious than an apple, it's kind of meaningless, because we can't actually define what that means, and we don't actually have the ability to measure that. Okay, so that was probably the biggest surprise to me, that it's very difficult to even define these things. And the things we do talk about are just the parts, the nutrient compounds that we know about, right? So we have about 20 that we talk about, all the minerals, calcium and phosphorus. We have the vitamins. So there's like, you know, half a dozen of those or so. And then we're starting to talk about some of the others, but there's like 5,000 nutrients that are important for our health. We don't even know what that number is yet. We think it's somewhere around 5,000. That's a guess. But there's 5,000 compounds, and they're all important for our health. And most of them, we have no idea what they do in our bodies, but we suspect that they're important for us.
Right? You do, you know, one of the fun parts of reading your book is at various points you go through myths about, right. And myth busting, and my eyebrows went up more than once. You start the book with a great one: if you can't pronounce it, don't eat it. And you say, no, just disregard that. Now, explain that.
Well, I think our society has a couple misconceptions. One is that anything that's a chemical is harmful. Right. So we talk about, a carrot is being good for us, but chemicals are bad for us. And most chemicals have names that the average person can't pronounce. So there's a lot of people who go around and say, well, geez, you know, just eat the healthy things. Like calcium, we can say, and that's good for you. But if you can't pronounce the word, don't eat it. It's not healthy. That's completely wrong. And in fact, I start the book, I think, with all the things in, I think they were bananas, and all the chemicals in bananas or carrots. It doesn't matter what you pick, anything you eat. There's thousands of these chemicals, and you can't pronounce the names of most of those things. And yet all of those chemicals are extremely important for us to eat. Okay, so the name of something, how it's pronounced, and the fact that it's a chemical has nothing to do with nutrition.
Okay. One of the reasons, I think one of the main reasons we grow our own food is to get better quality.
Right.
But do we?
It depends how you define quality. So if you define quality as being fresh food, then that's one of the biggest advantages of growing it yourself. So I can grow beans in the garden. I can pick them at the ripeness that I really like. Okay. And I can go to the garden and pick them, and I can eat them in the garden, or I can bring them in the kitchen and eat them right away. And that's the big advantage. Now, if we define quality as being very nutritious, then we have to ask the question, is the bean from my garden more nutritious than the bean I can get at the local grocery store? And the answer to that is, we really don't know. All right. It's quite possible that the bean in the grocery store was grown in better conditions than I'm growing in my backyard, which makes it more nutritious. But the bottom line is, we have no way of measuring that. I can't pick up two beans and say, okay, this one's more nutritious than this other one. It might look fresher. It's, you know, it's not wrinkled. It's not overripe and so on. But as far as nutrition goes, I have really no way to know which of those are more nutritious.
Yeah.
So I think the quality aspect really comes down to that freshness and I can pick them the way I want. So let's go with tomatoes, for instance. I mean, people complain about tomatoes in the grocery store. They don't taste very good. And one of the reasons is that those tomatoes get picked very early, and they're not fully ripe when they're in the grocery store. And it's a cultivar that's been grown for shipping so that they don't get bruised, because nobody's going to buy a bruised tomato in the grocery store. So that becomes really critical for farmers. We have to grow these tomatoes. We have to ship them across the country. They can't get bruised. They can't be mushy. They have to be in a firm condition. And so we've bred them that way. Now, as a gardener, I can go and say, well, I prefer my tomatoes riper. I want them redder. And as a gardener, I can go out and select varieties that I really like the taste of. So I can grow things that are not practical for a farmer to grow. And so I can choose that tomato. And of course, that's quality, right? Flavor, color, all of that is part of that quality equation. And I can pick one that I really like. In fact, I like tomatoes because if you ask, you know, three people about what is your favorite tomato, and they're all gardeners, so they've grown various ones, they all have a different answer, right? I love the Sweet 100 cherry tomato. And I've been growing it for almost 50 years. And it's, to me, it's the very best tomato that is ever made. But I have friends who swear by yellow tomatoes, which I've never really cared for. Okay? But they really like them. They taste good. They grow them and so on. They have their favorite. I have my favorite. And we might garden right next to each other. Okay? So that's one aspect of gardening that you just can't get from a grocery store, right? In a grocery store, you might have three types, and that's about it.
Yeah. One advantage, and you do point this out in the book, for those tomatoes that are grown for the grocery store market, is that you can get a fresh tomato in January in Wisconsin.
That's right. You can get fresh tomatoes and any other fruit all year long. And if we look at this from a nutrition point of view, that's actually a big advantage. Let's take something like that we understand an orange has vitamin C in it. I can get those all year long. And so I can get my vitamin C even in the wintertime. Right? That didn't happen 100 years ago. 100 years ago, oranges were available for a month, maybe 2 months, and that was it. You didn't get any more. So even though we complain a lot about the quality in our store, the availability is tremendous these days. And part of that, again, has to do with the fact that we've created cultivars that ship really well.
Yeah.
Right? And I know people who eat those fruits and vegetables don't really like them as much, but the fact that you can get them all year and you can get the nutrition you want all year long is a great plus.
Marie in Waukesha has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Marie.
Well, hi there. So last winter, in the summer, I raised my vegetables in a raised bed. So I put in good organic soil, and I bought the same organic soil last winter and grew peas and beans, and they were flavorless. And the only thing I can think of is it's got to be the light. That's the only thing that was different.
So you grew the beans and peas indoors in the same soil that you grew them in outside, and the flavor changed, basically.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I have the little LED or whatever grow lights.
Yeah. All right. Well, Robert, what's your thought?
Okay, well, let's first look at the light. I see a lot of people saying I'm growing things indoors under LED lights, or they call them grow lights. There's a wide range of grow lights available. Everything from lights that are so strong that they actually match the light from the sun, to ones that most gardeners buy, which have almost no light at all. To our eyes, they look very bright, but that doesn't mean they're bright from the plant's perspective. Most of the lower cost LED lights and grow lights that are available on the market are very low light level lamps, which means the plants aren't getting enough light. And that is a real problem. And the environment, both temperature and light, is really important for growth and for flavor in vegetables. So I'm not entirely surprised that they perhaps don't taste as well. They don't taste as good when they're grown indoors. I'm sure light has a lot to do with it. The other thing, of course, is the fertilizing. Now, in your case, it sounds as if you've grown them in the same soil and the same fertilizer, so that may not be an issue. A lot of people will grow outside in real soil, and now nutrient levels are really important. And people who grow indoors in pots and soilless mixes or hydroponically, they have a very hard time keeping nutrient levels at the correct level. And if you don't do that, then you'll again suffer as far as the plant growth goes and as far as the flavor goes.
Hmm. Interesting. Marie, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. We're talking today with Robert Pavlis. Robert's book is titled Food Science for Gardeners and subtitle Grow, Harvest, and Prepare Nutrient-Dense Food. Great to have him with us, and you can join in, too. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Talking with Robert Pavlis, his book titled Food Science for Gardeners. Great to have him with us. And again, you can join in with your own thoughts at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. And let's go to Mary Kay in Kenosha. Mary Kay, thank you for calling.
Hi, I used to garden. I go to the store now. I'm noticing that the top part of the state of Wisconsin has everything you want. It's got different kinds of squashes, tomatoes, blueberries, grapes, everything. But from the middle on down, the stores don't have any yellow tomatoes, no different kinds of squashes, different kinds of avocados, different kinds of head lettuce. You know, the grapes and the melon aren't local. So I don't understand why the top part of the state is all healthy, but the rest isn't.
Well, the rest isn't. Well,
I don't have a comment. I don't know what kind of stores you have. It may be due to what is grown locally. Is it possible that the northern part of the state is growing some of these things locally and the southern part is not? And so the stores in the northern part have easier access to that kind of food?
There may be some of those foods more locally available, and the grocery stores that's larger, perhaps, in the more densely populated areas, are, you know, zeroing in on fewer varieties.
Right. Yeah, the larger chains certainly will buy their fruits and vegetables from other places and bring them in large quantities. So that may have a lot to do with it.
I'm not sure. She did mention also about acid and yellow tomatoes having less acid. And I wanted to bring that up because you spent a bit of time talking about acidity in tomatoes. Let's get into that a bit, Robert.
Okay. So just to explain to people, one of my passions is myth busting gardening topics, which I've been doing for many, many years. The question is there such a thing as an acid tomato? And of course, a lot of people think there are. And experts in tomatoes and in gardening have looked at this and decided, no, there's no such thing as an acid tomato. They all have almost the same pH. So I looked at it and I found, well, in fact, that's not really true. It's confusing if you don't know what pH is. So pH sounds like just a number. And the range in tomatoes goes, I have to guess here, but 4.3 to 4.7, something like that. It's not a wide range. It doesn't sound like a wide range, but if you understand what pH is, you realize it's a logarithmic number. So that's actually a huge difference from 4.3 to 4.7. Okay, it doesn't sound like it as a number, but when you look at it as a logarithmic value and the concentration, it's quite significant. So there are acid tomatoes. Now, the other thing that happens is in all the seed catalogs, almost everybody thinks that the acid tomatoes are the yellow ones. That's a complete myth. Okay, the color of the tomato and the acidity have nothing to do with one another. Right. The second thing that I found out was that the acidity depends very much on where you grow them. So there was a really nice research study where they got like 20 different kinds of tomatoes and they grew them on the same farm so that they could compare them. And they found some were more acidic than others. Then they looked at those same varieties all over the U.S. And they found in certain parts of the country, didn't matter which one you grew, they had the same pH. Okay. In other parts of the country, they had a variety of pHs. So the acidity of a tomato depends on the cultivar and on where it's grown. There are certain parts of the country, like half of the U.S., you cannot grow acidic tomatoes because your soil doesn't allow you to do that. So you have to live in the right state and pick the right cultivar, ignore the color of the tomato, and you can grow tomatoes that are less or more acidic.
Yeah.
So that's the bottom line. It's a little complicated.
Well, there were some other myths that I did want to bring up. A couple that caught my attention. Well, one, on nutrition value, I always thought or was always told that potato skins are more nutritious than the flesh.
Right.
And you say that's not the case.
That's not really the case. There's very little difference between those. And in fact, it turns out that potatoes are actually toxic to us. Right? They have a compound in there called solanine. And that's a toxic compound. In fact, tomatoes, peppers, potatoes, they all have it. They're all in the same family, and they all have this chemical in there. And if we eat too much of it, it can harm us. It turns out that in potatoes, most of that chemical is in the skin. So, in fact, if you want to make your potatoes healthier, they're actually healthier if you take the skin off, because that's where the toxins are. All right. The reality is that most potatoes are quite safe to eat. I mean, if you're going to eat 50 pounds a day, then you may have a problem with this issue, right? But if you eat, you know, a couple potatoes every day, it's not an issue. But yeah, the inside of the potatoes is much more nutritious. And in fact, there's many myths like that. The other one I came across was bananas. You know, bananas have really high calcium levels.
Yeah.
Well, they don't actually have high calcium levels. They're higher than some things, but they're about the same as many of the fruits and vegetables we eat. They're not particularly high in calcium or phosphorus. So many of these things that we think about vegetables are actually turn out not to be quite true.
Our guest today is talking with us about his book. Robert Pavlis, our guest, and the book is Food Science for Gardeners. Questions for him, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@wpr.org. We have a comment from David in Madison. He says it's true that we can't see nutrition. For example, when making wine, his nutrition on organic grapes is around 125 parts per million. Drumlin Ridge Winery in town fertilizes, and they test at 500 parts per million for nitrogen.
For nitrogen or for nutrition?
Oh, he said, yeah, I bet it's nutrition. It's coming out nitrogen, but that might have been a spell. You know how that works. Spell checks.
I know how that works. Yeah. So let's look at the one question is, you know, do we have a nutrition number like that? Like he gave a number and said, that's the nutrition number. There is no such thing. Okay. And in fact, this gets back to the first thing we talked about, is that we can't even agree on how to measure nutrition. So until we do that, we can't have a number. There is no such thing as a nutrition number. Now, there is something called a BRICS number. And there are gardening circles where they believe that BRICS is a measure of nutrition. And grapes is one of those areas, okay? And there's a reason why grape growers measure BRICS, but it's not really nutrition. So let's ask the question, what is BRICS? Well, BRICS is a measurement of everything inside the grape. So we squeeze some juice out, we measure it, we get a reading, and it includes everything in there. Unfortunately, 95% of what's in there is sugar. So we're measuring sugar concentration. We're not measuring nutrition. Okay. I can have a grape and I can triple the amount of vitamin C in that grape. I won't see a difference in that number because that number is mostly sugar. And in fact, if I take a grape, I'll get one reading. And if I dry it and turn it into a raisin, I will get a really high reading because now the sugar is concentrated because I lost all the water. So bottom line is BRICS tells us nothing about nutrition. It tells us about how sweet these grapes are, which is a value in the wine industry. So when they're harvesting grapes, they do measure BRICS, and it is important in their processing and so on. So there's value there, but they're measuring sugar, not nutrition. So some gardeners have come along and said, well, geez, it's really easy to measure BRICS. You can buy one of these little meters for $100 and you can go and measure your things. And there's lots of people who think that nutrition and BRICS are the same thing. They're not.
Susan in Appleton has something for us. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Larry.
What's on your mind?
So I'm really curious. Last year, there were so many acorns, it was unbelievable. This year, I haven't seen a single acorn.
Okay, I assume you're talking about the nut.
Yeah.
So this is something that most trees do, fruit trees, nut trees, really any tree, because all trees, of course, are making some sort of a fruit, right? So what they'll tend to do is, they will have a year when they produce a lot, and then the following year or two, they'll produce very little, and then they'll go back and produce a lot again. And they go through this cycle on a regular basis. Okay, so the same thing happens with all your fruit trees. One year you got a booming year, you got all these apples. Next year you got almost nothing. And you're wondering, what did I do wrong? Okay, it's has nothing to do with you. In fact, one of the things that's important is to understand that the fruit you get this year on your tree is actually due mostly to the environment the tree had last year. It's not what you did this year. It's the year before. Now, nut trees do this. I mean, all trees do it naturally, but there's another reason why nut trees do it. Okay? There's animals that like that food, and mostly squirrels. Right. So if the trees produce the same amount every year, the squirrels would get most of them and they wouldn't produce very many seedlings. So what these trees do is one year they'll produce so many nuts that the squirrels can't eat them all. And they end up with a lot of seedlings. Remember that the tree's main goal in life is to make babies. So they're producing so many, the squirrels can't eat them all. They produce a whole bunch of young. And then next year, there's this drop. And what happens? Well, the squirrels actually starve to death. And so their population goes down. So for a couple of years, the population drops and drops and drops. And then they throw a huge amount of acorns on the ground again, right? And this is a known cycle that just repeats. And it repeats with most trees. So it's nothing to do with you. It has nothing to do with the environment. It's just you're going to have these cycles.
Susan, there you go. Thank you for calling. Margaret in Fort Atkinson, we'll go to you now. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. This is a follow-up question to the growing things inside and the grow light.
Yeah.
What type of light? I've been just using the fluorescent, the LED lights, you know, from Menards. What do you recommend? And what about the temperature for growing like greens
indoors.
In the winter. And,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
So greens like lettuce, for instance, they can grow fairly cool, but they will grow just fine in a normal room temperature. They might do a little better in the basement, though, or if it's a little cooler there. As far as the light goes, the Menard LED type strip lights, they're okay. They will grow low-level plants like lettuce. They're not going to grow high-level plants like tomatoes. Okay. If you really want to grow more food and grow it faster, buy some real LEDs and their grow lights. And the product will tell you two things. One is it will give you the spectra of the light to show you what wavelengths you have. If it doesn't do that, it's not a real grow light. The second thing is that it will tell you how much light it's outputting. And again, you notice a big difference. If you go like on Amazon and you look at some of the cheaper bulbs, they don't give you those two pieces of information, even though they call it a grow light. And without those two pieces of information, you know this is not a real grow light. A real grow light will give you both of those information, and they're critical. But that's the only way to compare two lights and say, okay, this one's stronger than this other one. Okay. For indoor growing, again, you can get away with leafy things. But if you want things to flower and you want larger plants that are taller, you need higher light output.
Yeah. And what would be a number? Is there a number in terms of output that for those higher end plants, let's call them?
Yeah, it's a PPFD value that you're looking for. And you want to be at least at 800.
At least at 800. Okay.
300 will grow lettuce and leafy house door plants. You need at least 500 to start flowering things.
Margaret, there you go. Thank you for calling. Mary in Appleton will go to you next. Hi, Mary.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have heard, my question is about how microwave heating affects the food. I have heard it destroys vitamins, also the integrity. I've read that at a couple places, and I just can't quite understand. Do you agree with that or disagree?
So one of the myths in the book is about microwaves, and I think there's three microwave myths, and one of them is that it destroys vitamins. Okay, that's a complete myth. So what a microwave is it's actually like a sound wave. So the things you're hearing from me, they're sound waves, and microwaves do the same thing, except the size of the wave is different. Okay? All the microwaves are doing is heating water molecules. The water absorbs those microwaves, and the extra energy that the water collects heats it up. So it's a way of heating water. And in fact, if you take something that's very dry and put it in a microwave, it hardly heats at all because it doesn't have any water in there. It has to have moisture. So what we're really doing when we microwave things is we're in effect boiling them, right? We're doing the same thing as we can do on the stovetop by putting something into a pan and just heating it. That's all microwaves are doing. So it doesn't really degrade food any more than heating will. So you can ask another question. Does heating or cooking degrade nutrition? Like, is fresh better than cooked? And the answer is very complicated. Okay. And the reason the answer is complicated is, remember, we're talking about 5,000 nutritious chemicals here, and they all do different things. So when we heat food, some of these will degrade. Vitamin C, for one, degrades very quickly when we heat it. So if I do it on a stovetop or in a microwave, my vitamin C level goes just down because it degrades with heat. However, heat also creates some other chemicals which are actually good for us. So some of the antioxidants are created when we heat things. So when we're cooking, we kind of get a plus and minus effect. Some of these nutrients will decrease and others will actually increase when we're heating it. Okay? But in general, microwave isn't any worse than cooking on a stovetop.
Okay. Mary, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Bob in Madison will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Very interesting. When you say that there's no standard for nutrition, measuring nutrition, I'm sure you're not satisfied with that as a scientist. You want to bring out, your goal is to identify what is the most nutritious. And so I'm interested, how do you value nutrition and what is your standard for nutrition and how do you measure it and what can you tell us to look for as consumers?
Mm-hmm. You're not going to like my answer. The answer is that the consumer really has no way to know about the nutrition of the food they're eating. They really have no way to compare two things. The example I had earlier is, what is more nutritious, an apple or an orange? Okay. We don't know. Okay. That's the simple answer. And one of the reasons we don't know that is we don't even know what all the chemical in those two fruits are that are important to us. Okay, we're still learning that. Every year we're finding new chemicals that we think are important in our diet. So we don't know what that list is yet. Now, I know that that goes against everything you've read and all the headlines in newspapers and so on, you know, that say so-and-so is more nutritious and so on. What they do, and when people say that, is they take a very small number of these chemicals and look at them. So we might take the vitamins and say, okay, there's six vitamins. We can say maybe an orange has more total vitamins than an apple. And if we only look at vitamins, it's more nutritious. But what about the antioxidants? Okay, they help us fight cancer. Okay, that's also important. So that's one aspect. There's another aspect here that I think we completely forget. And that is that we can make a list of these nutrients, but we also have to ask, which of these do we need? Okay. And a good example is vitamin C. Everybody talks about vitamin C. You know, we just talked about it. Do microwaves degrade vitamin C? Well, they do. But do we care? Well, it turns out that most people in North America have a diet that actually gives them too much vitamin C. And the excess can't be stored in our bodies. We're not able to hold it. It comes out of our urine. Okay, so eating 10 oranges a day is not going to do you any good. You're not going to have any more vitamins because it just comes out of your urine. Okay? So you now have lots of vitamin C. Should we even consider that as a nutrient that's important for us? And the answer is no, because we don't need any more. Now, if you're in a third world country, vitamin C becomes really important, and that may be more important than a lot of other things. The other ones are the minerals, calcium, phosphorus, and so on. In our diet in North America, we generally get lots of those, partly because we eat a variety of food, partly because a lot of our food is actually enhanced with these. So if you drink milk, you get extra calcium. Phosphorus, I can't remember what it's put in. There's a food we generally all eat, and it has extra phosphorus added. So when we know there's a lack of these, we can actually put it in our food, and we get enough. So in North America, we rarely have a mineral deficiency. So should we care about the mineral content of the food? Maybe antioxidants are more important to us because they're going to help prevent cancer, right? I know you'd like to have a nice answer, but there isn't one. We scientists today still have a long way to go before they can even give you a list and say, these are the things you need to eat.
Yeah.
Okay.
Our guest today, Robert Pavlis, his book, Food Science for Gardeners, Grow, Harvest, and Prepare Nutrient-Dense Food. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Talking today with Robert Pavlis about his book, Food Science for Gardeners, Grow, Harvest, and Prepare Nutrient-Dense Food. Just a quick mention, in the next hour of the show, we'll be talking about growing edible tropical plants in your home. So we'll be looking at that with our next guest. But right now, we're taking a look at Food Science for Gardeners, and Wayne in Hortonville has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning. Hey, got a curious question for you. Wondering about the MythBuster with ash when prepping a soil for gardens. Is it good to put ash from, let's say, a fire pit in there?
Well, that depends. So always go back to the thing you're adding and understand it. So ash is the remains of the stuff that's left after it burns and has lots of minerals in it. So it does have nutrients. So that sounds like a good thing to add to your soil. The problem with ash is it also has a really high pH. So what is the pH of your soil? Where I garden, our pH is 7.4, so it's already alkaline. We're trying to make it a little more acidic because plants love to be around 6.5, right? So in my garden, adding ash only increases the pH, which is not good for plants. So I wouldn't use it. Now, if you're gardening in an acidic soil and you're trying to raise your pH anyways, then ash would be a good choice. There are also some claims about ash getting rid of pests and some things. That really doesn't work. But the ash does have nutrition in it. It's good for the soil, except for the effect on pH.
Yeah. Do you recommend testing your soil?
Well, interesting. Yes and no. So if I lived in the U.S., so by the way, I'm for the listeners, I'm in Canada, on Ontario. In the U.S., your soil test is pretty inexpensive. So if I lived there, I probably would test it more frequently. In the rest of the world, soil tests are quite expensive. Okay, I'll pay 4 or 5 times what you guys pay for a soil test. So it's pretty expensive. Now, there are reasons why I don't recommend a soil test. And the number one reason is that the nutrient that is most likely needed in your soil is nitrogen, and a soil test doesn't test for that. All right. So you get all the other numbers back, and the lab may recommend nitrogen, but they're making a guess. We don't measure nitrogen traditionally in soil. Farmers can do it, and it's an extra expense and so on. But for gardeners, we don't measure nitrogen. That's the nutrient you probably need. So you're missing the main point. The second reason I wouldn't recommend it is that most gardeners don't follow the advice. Okay, so you get your test results, and if it's done in a proper lab, they will say add so much potassium, add so much phosphorus, and so on. To do that, you're going to go to the store and look for fertilizer that has those amounts, and you're not going to find it. You probably have to buy 2 or 3 different fertilizers and mix them together and do all the calculations to figure out how much to add of each one. Gardeners don't do that. They will get frustrated, go to the store and buy a 10-10-10 and spread it around. If you're going to do that, don't waste money on the soil test. And by the way, anyone who's listening, a 10-10-10 is always the wrong fertilizer for your soil. Okay? Yeah. No matter what all those sites are telling you, yeah, Nobody needs a balanced fertilizer. The middle number should almost always be small. Okay, that's the phosphorus. And most soil in North America has lots of phosphorus. We don't need to add more. Okay.
In fact, it's illegal in some areas. The phosphorus isn't even a part of the fertilizers.
That's right. It's been taken out in a lot of places because we don't need it. Now, what I suggest you do is grow stuff. Okay. If the stuff is growing well, don't worry about the soil test. Now, if your plants are not growing well, okay, they have colored leaves, they're short, they're doing something funny, they're not doing well, then you need a soil test. You cannot identify nutrient deficiency by looking at your plants. And again, that's another thing that you'll find all over the internet. You'll find these little memes and diagrams say, well, if it's yellow, it's this and so on. Those are all wrong. You cannot identify nutrient deficiency by looking at your plants. So if they're not growing well, definitely get a soil test.
All right. Let's talk about pesticides for a minute. How concerned should we be about them?
Not nearly as concerned as people are. So there's two key things. One is we do use pesticides in a lot of places. The amount of those pesticides is extremely small. The amount on our fruits and vegetables is extremely small. It's such a low level that it really is not a concern. The other thing that very few gardeners know is that 99.9% of the pesticides you eat are natural. Okay, if you think about it, a plant can't run away from its pests. It just sits there. So the only way it can fight pests is to make toxic chemicals. These are natural pesticides that the plant makes, and they make thousands of these things. So 99.9% of the pesticides you consume come from the plant. That thing that we tell you is nutritious and good to eat is making most of those pesticides. A very tiny amount comes from sprays. Okay. The other way to look at this is that if you look at the synthetic pesticides that you get from all the fruits and vegetables you eat in a whole year, and you look at those that are carcinogens, so we're measuring carcinogens now, you get the equivalent amount in one cup of coffee. Okay, the number of carcinogens in one cup of coffee is about the same as you will consume in a year's worth of fruits and vegetables. And yet we drink coffee every day, sometimes many times a day, and we don't worry about it. And yet when it comes to fruits and vegetables, everyone is so concerned about those pesticides.
There are so many interesting points and myths that you discuss in the book. In our last couple of minutes, what's your favorite one?
Well, one that I spent a fair amount of time understanding is how do tomatoes get ripe?
Yeah.
And let's ask this question. Can you pick an unripe tomato and ripen it on your kitchen counter? All right. And I'll bet 8 out of 10 gardeners will say, no, it has to be vine ripened. And I believe that my whole life. I've been gardening since I was 20, so that's a long time ago. And I always believed that. It had to be good and juicy and red on the vine. If I pick it early, it just won't taste as good. That's a complete myth. Okay? And it has to do with when the plant has ripe fruit or mature fruit. Okay, when that tomato has a little bit of pink coloration, the plant thinks it's finished. The seeds can be harvested at that point and grown. As far as the tomato plant is concerned, that is a mature fruit. All right. Now, as far as humans go and chipmunks go, we want them the red, so we don't eat it at that point. We wait. But if you harvest with a little pink and you bring it inside and let it sit on the counter, don't put it in the fridge. Has to be warm, it will ripen and taste just as good as one that you leave on the vine. Okay. Now, the bonus is that the birds and the chipmunks don't come along and peck at it and chew on it. So you get better tomatoes that way.
There are so many things that we haven't covered in your book, Robert. But I have had a lot of fun talking with you today about it, and I've certainly enjoyed reading your book, and I hope we have a chance to talk again. You raise a lot of very interesting observations that I think a lot of gardeners would say, what?
It was great. I'd love to come back, and I have so many myths. Thousands of them. So we won't run out of things to talk about.
We won't indeed. In the meantime, the book is Food Science for Gardeners: Grow, Harvest, and Prepare Nutrient-Dense Food. We didn't even get to all of that. And it's in the book. So coming up, though, we're going to talk about growing figs, coffee, chocolate right in your house. We'll do that next. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Thank you, Robert.